From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
There's an expansive government sector, largely invisible, that most citizens know little about. They're called special districts, and they come in all shapes and sizes, covering everything from fire protection districts, flood control districts, irrigation districts, veterans memorial districts, and even community cemetery districts, just to name a few. The Little Hoover Commission recently took a look at these special districts. Our guest, Carol D'Alia, the executive director of Little Hoover Commission, will tell us what they found out about these largely unknown local government entities. What's so special about special districts?
We'll also hear from leaders of the local agency formation commissions, known as county LAFCOs, throughout the valley, whose mission includes making even the smallest special district more efficient and effective. And we'll also hear from one special district that is actually award-winning and is here right in the valley.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. So what is a special district? It could be one of 29 varieties. It almost sounds like ketchup. You have airport districts, you've got flood control districts, you've got veterans memorial districts, all kinds of districts. In fact, there are thousands, literally, in the state of California. And they collect billions of dollars, and they employ tens of thousands of workers. But only the most avid policy wonk really knows who they are and what they do. We're going to see if we can get our audience up to speed on special districts with the help of Carol D'Alia, the executive director of Little Hoover Commission, who recently conducted an in-depth study on these little-known but highly influential local government agencies. So we'll start off, what is a special district?
A special district is very simple. It's a local government that's created by community residents to provide a specific service or to fill a void where maybe the service is being provided but not adequately. So they typically have a locally elected board, and they're funded through potentially property tax revenues, fees, depending on the type of the district, or sometimes both.
I think people might be looking at their ballot sometimes and see this on that they have no idea what these organizations do. Well, in 2000, almost 20 years ago, the legislature expanded the authority of these things called LAFCOs to conduct what's called municipal service reviews of these special districts. I know it's a little bit policy wonkish there, but what are these municipal service reviews and what are they supposed to do?
Sure. So to back up a little, back in the 60s, the California legislature and the governor had the foresight to create these local agency formation commissions, or LAFCOs. And it was at a time the state was growing by leaps and bounds, and their role was really to set local boundaries. But they also got a role in overseeing special districts.
And they're in every county.
All 58.
All 58 counties have a LAFCO. Okay.
And so in 2000, there was a lot of reform efforts, and they were given expanded duties, one of which was this municipal service review. And so basically they're tasked with going out, looking at a special district or other local government, figuring out what service do you provide, is this the most efficient, the most effective way of doing it, coming back with recommendations, maybe there's some performance improvements, or maybe they recommend that this district should be dissolved or consolidated.
Past its prime. So what did you guys also did, the Little Hoover Commission did a report about special districts in 2000. What did you find?
So at that juncture, we found that there were these districts, many of them proliferated in from the early 1900s, particularly in the 50s and later. And many of them were potentially no longer serving the purpose that they were designed for. So we found that they were slow to change their ways, slow to consider consolidations. We had some serious concerns at the time, and again with some of the reserve issues, how money set aside to do what. We also had some issues with the lack of transparency. Back in 2000, a lot of these didn't even have websites. It was hidden government at the worst.
Right. It's interesting. People are concerned about fraud, waste, and abuse. These special districts collecting a lot of money. People don't really know what's going on with them. And so this is an area ripe for review. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there was a proliferation of special districts in the 60s. Today, how does California compare to other states when it comes to the use of special districts?
So this study was really interesting in that we found California had really exploded. I mean, we had very rural communities, and they had needs. flood control, irrigation districts, very important things that are vital to growing communities. So they proliferated all the way through the 70s up until about 1997 is when they peaked. In California, they've actually declined by 5%, whereas we found nationally they're still growing, and it's grown by 10%. So we've actually reined in a little bit.
So why the new review? You just did this new review on special districts. Why?
So there were a couple reasons. One, it was to look back and say, you know, we made these recommendations 17 years ago, what's happened? But we also, in the 15-16 legislative session, there was a proliferation of bills that were targeting special districts, which sent a flag to the commission saying, you know, is there a reason that these local issues are percolating up to the legislature? Is there a reason that maybe the local process isn't working? So we wanted to look at that.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, because that is democracy, right? And usually democracy mm-hmm. responds to an issue. They're not proactive, mm-hmm. they're reactive. Mm-hmm. And so they're probably, that's why it was these things were appearing in front of the legislature, these bills, and you caught that. So,
right.
So you decided to do a report. What were your general findings of how special districts can really improve their efficiency and effectiveness?
So this was really interesting. As you described at the beginning, there was no one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. solution. What works for the Metropolitan Water District serving millions of people in Southern California isn't going to work for the cemetery or the library district. But so where we focused and where our recommendations typically are found are on the areas of oversight. Are these LAFCOs, are they doing their job? Do they have the right authority? Is there some obstruction? Is there an obstacle? Is something that could be done differently? And then on transparency, as we looked at previously, how do people know what are these districts? Who do they serve? Where does their money come from? What do they spend it on? Who are their boards? How do they get involved? So those were the two general areas that we looked at.
Interesting. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about special districts, those that have outlived their usefulness. What do you do? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking about special districts. Over 2,000 of them exist in California, collecting billions of local tax dollars. What can be done to make them more efficient and effective? We're talking with Carol D'Alia, head of the Little Hoover Commission, that recently conducted an in-depth analysis of special districts in California. You know, your first recommendation seems to be that the legislature and the governor basically should butt out, should stop interfering with the LAFCO deliberative process. In fact, you state that they should only get involved when, quote, the local governing elites are so intransigent or negligent or so beholden to entrenched power structures that some higher form of political authority is necessary. That's a mouthful, unquote.
Yeah.
So how do you make that determination? How
okay.
do you know?
So again, these are local districts created by local community members. And you had, as I described earlier in this segment, this percolating up to the legislature where you have 120 people from all over the state deciding an issue that really affects, you know, one little district inside one county. And so on the surface, it doesn't seem like that's a good idea, and because you're not going to have people knowing what's going on in that particular county. So, yeah, when does it hit that point where it is just so intractable? I think when you've had a successful LAFCO, which there are many in the state, trying and trying again and having nothing happen, or there are corners of the state where the LAFCOs, either because they have inadequate resources or just have...
Well, some of them are understaffed.
Yeah, understaffed, and maybe their appointees are entrenched in the local politics, and you have community members who are saying, hey, wait a minute, my property taxes are going to this thing. I've gone to the LAFCO. I haven't got satisfaction. This is still happening, and then that's when it rises to the legislature.
Some of these, I would assume that some of these special districts, they have people that get elected year after year after year, and nobody even knows who they are, and they're just basically doing this with nobody looking over their shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you rarely, in fact, I've never seen a report, I think, from the Little Hoover Commission that actually recommends additional funding. That's never really your answer as a solution to a problem. But this time you did. Why and what should it be used for, or how much?
So it's really budget dust, maybe $1 million to $3 million.
I'm sure when our audience hears like $1 million to $3 million, that's not budget dust. But really, when you talk about, you know, $120 or so billion state budget, it really is.
Right. And in your thinking, in the perspective of, could this in the long run save taxpayer dollars? And that's the intent. It's like, here we could make a little bit of an investment, and what would it go towards? It would help some of the low-hanging fruit where they just don't have the money to consolidate. They know they need to, they want to. And so you could perhaps take five districts and turn it into one, get rid of a lot of bureaucracy. So the end game would be to save money.
I think I have a tag slogan for this: millions for billions. Because you've got $20 billion special districts you're spending. If you spend a million or to three to then maybe get rid of some of these special districts, you can then save a tremendous amount of money. I think that's basically your point. You also note in your report that there are an unknown number of inactive districts statewide. All of these are candidates that are for dissolution. That resulted actually in the passage of a bill this year, SB 448. How will that address the problem?
So that gives the local LAFCO the authority to do away with these inactive districts. So right now you've got a lot of these districts that are on the books, and the process to eliminate them is expensive. You know, it requires potentially a vote. And so this is going to ease the red tape on at least those that are inactive. And no one even knows, as we said, we don't even know how many there are. So that'll get rid of some low-hanging fruit.
There was another thing that happened in the legislature this year, AB 979, also one of your recommendations. It attempts to strengthen LAFCOs by giving special districts a voice.
Right.
How would it do that?
So currently, 30 LAFCOs have special district representation, and the other 28 don't. And it's been determined that where special districts have a role, not only sometimes is there potentially a little bit more money, but there's a better balance of the district's perspective with the city and the county. Over time, the other 28 counties, there's just a lot of bureaucracy. So this would give a one-time easy process. One swoop, okay, now we can add special districts to these other 28 counties.
It gives them, and also probably helps those deliberations, when the board's having deliberations, some expertise to discuss those issues. You noted that some LAFCO reps serve on an at-will basis, in other words, at the will of their appointing agencies. You didn't like that. You thought that was a bad idea. So why did you recommend that the legislature create fixed terms for LAFCO members?
So this actually was a recommendation that came to us from CalLAFCO. And they said they had a lot of nuts and bolts types of things. These are the things that could help. And they said not across the board. There's plenty of LAFCOs that have folks who serve terms, but others, they don't. So if somebody's on there and they make a decision that doesn't meet the political winds, yank, they get yanked off. So we kind of envisioned it just like our own commissioners are appointed by the governor and the legislative leadership, and they have fixed terms. So while they may have a perspective that the governor or their appointing authority agrees with, they don't have to worry if they make a hard decision.
Right. Next week they're off the board of the panel.
So it's in that spirit.
Okay. You also think that the legislature should simplify the process of consolidations and dissolutions of special districts to create more consistency. What's wrong with the current procedure?
It's really confusing. It's hard for even, you know, us as we were looking at it, experts, not clear at all to the citizens who are supposed to make decisions. So the LAFCO process, for example, in order to consolidate or dissolve a district, has a certain threshold where a vote's required. It's different if the district itself initiates it. So there was some discussion about, you know, making them consistent, changing them, and where we ended was, at the end of the day, we don't want to just pick something out of the blue and say, okay, now here's the new rule. We wanted to just simplify it so the people could understand. Here's this process, it's clean. This is why it works this way.
Yeah, sometimes like barnacles on a ship. It just keep adding these rules. Sometimes you just need to simplify things. Last question of the segment, I want to ask you about financial management. That was another issue you addressed in your report. And you focused on reserve funds, the size of them, the purpose of them, and how they're invested. What did you come up with there?
So this was a particularly thorny issue back in 2000 when we started our original study, and it came up again. There's a camp of folks that we heard from in our public hearing process that say there's just too much money. They're sitting on vast sums of money.
And so to be clear, if they sit on a reserve, that means that money is not being used for the purpose it was intended, right? It's just being parked.
That's what one camp said. The other camp said, this is good fiscal policy. We're being prudent. We're prepared for a rainy day should something
happen.
But
you have to balance those two interests. Okay. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about special districts, how they can be more transparent, and what should be done when these special districts are no longer special. That is, they've outlived their usefulness. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, and we're talking with Carol D'Alia, the executive director of California's Little Hoover Commission, about a recent report they did on special districts. So let's talk about improving transparency and engaging the public. One thing you think that they could do better at is websites. And you're actually very specific about what you'd like to see them do. So what do you think should be included on these special district websites?
Sure. So first, not all of them have a website. So
that's a good place to start.
Let's start there. But then
actually, when you say that, it's a little hard to believe that this day and age that they don't have a website.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, so we start with a website, and then what do we do?
Okay, we were pretty basic. I mean, you know, who do they serve? What's their geography? Who are their clients? How many employees do they have? What is their payroll? Where does the revenue come from? What are they spending it on? What is their reserve policy? Pretty basic, straightforward government stuff, in our opinion.
You know, a lot of this info, though, isn't that reported to the state controller? So why not just have a link on the special district website right to the state controller, and they can find it there.
And we agree with that. I mean, we wouldn't want to create more work because, as you're saying, to put these things on the website, that means somebody has to update them and make sure they're, you know, not years old. So, yeah, if the info is there on the state controller's website and they want a link, that's fine.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I chair of a community foundation, and we are very careful about spending money. We have a website, but you know, it's a cost, and a donor doesn't typically want to see money spent on administration. So I'm assuring a taxpayer or someone who's paying into a special district doesn't really want to see money spent on a website. But again, mm-hmm. if you spend a little money to have a website so it's clear, maybe taxpayers can spot where there's money that's not being spent properly. So it's, in the long run, probably a good thing, mm-hmm. kind of just being prudent. So I want to ask you about, the ballots on elections for special districts. You know, I'm willing to bet that most people, when they look at a ballot, this long ballot, and they get down to special districts, first of all, they probably have no idea what the special district does. And so they're not probably even going to vote, much less run for a board or for a seat for that special district. So how do you get the public more engaged and involved with special districts?
Sure. We did find some signs of improvement there. So the California Special Districts Association, and they have a partnership with the Institute for Local Government, they've been trying to work with special districts to help them on public engagement. So not just on a one-time basis where maybe they want to go out and raise money, but on an ongoing basis. So there is this acknowledgement that they exist, that there are opportunities to serve. There's a lot that can be done. What we did find, though, is this is a problem that goes beyond special districts. We had a hearing on voter participation on a different topic, mm-hmm. and our commissioners asked some of the county registrars, well, what's the local voting like? They gave us data, and it wasn't just special districts. It was school districts. It was city council, county boards. So it's a bigger problem than special districts.
Yeah, and if they make it, you know, and I look at websites of local government agencies, and sometimes they're very easy to navigate. You can find information. Other times, it is a circuitous route. I mean, you're trying to find this information. It's like, and I'm sitting there, and I'm studying it. It takes me 2 hours to kind of find the information I want when it should be more simple, mm-hmm. so people can really access that information. That's a really good point. You didn't evaluate every district, though. You were looking at districts generally, but you did focus on one type of district in particular, and that was these healthcare districts that no longer manage or operate hospitals. Now, these districts were set up, in the 1940s to build hospitals in rural areas where people didn't have access to hospitals. But today, less than half of the current healthcare districts apparently actually run hospitals. So is this an example of a governmental agency that's outlived its usefulness?
So what we found was where once was a rural community is now part of the Bay Area, part of Southern California coast. So they evolved over time, and yet the district remained. A lot of hospitals have gone out of business. There is an emphasis on preventative care. So there's that issue going on. That
could they transition and fill that void instead of doing hospitals, running a hospital, get more into preventive care, preventive health care?
And the better ones have. And that's where there was no one size fits all. We found complaints from witnesses and even a board member on one of these healthcare districts saying, this needs to go away. We are, you know, taking property tax revenues and we're just doing grants. We own property. We're leasing out property. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we found districts that were very targeted at one, for example, childhood obesity. That was their problem. They had a targeted plan. They measured their results.
Yeah, I was going to say metrics are, if they can show that the money being spent is actually resulting in something, there's a return on that investment, and then people are going to say, okay. But if they're not, right. there's no there, then people are going to, well, why am I spending the money on this?
Right.
Interesting. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about the future of healthcare. I'm sorry, not just healthcare districts, but special districts generally in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking about local special districts with Carol D'Alia, the executive director of the Little Hoover Commission. They recently did a report on these over 2,000 local special districts that exist in California that generate over $20 billion in tax revenue that most people know little to nothing about. So let's talk about the issue of reserves. We touched on it a little earlier. Let's talk a little more about that. You know, the rainy day funds. A thorny issue in your 2000 report, still an issue in this most recent report. How can voters be assured that there isn't too much money or too little money being set aside? The amount of money being set aside is just right.
That's a hard thing to gauge, because what works for one district is not necessarily going to work for the next district. So where we focused a lot on this was on those districts with infrastructure. And what we found when we peeled back the onion a little bit was some of the things that were said to be reserved was actually either infrastructure itself, a facility, or it was money set aside to pay back a bond, which makes sense. So what's enough, what's not enough, it really depends on the district and what need they're serving.
It kind of, I mean, sometimes a rule of thumb in business, what, 5% or 10% reserve to kind of, you know. But again, the more money you set aside in a reserve, which is appropriate and prudent, but it's also money that's not working for you. And so that's a real balance, and that's a policy decision that boards have to make. You know, it seems that there are some special districts, irrigation districts, wastewater districts, flood control districts, that are really on the front lines of adapting to climate change. You guys have done a report earlier on climate change, the impacts of that, and how we should be thinking about addressing those. What do you think these special districts in the front lines of this issue should be doing to prepare for the impacts of climate change?
So, you know, as you mentioned, we've done work in this area before. We focused a lot on what was the state's role, what was the city-county role. Well, as we were doing this report on special districts, we realized these are the folks on the front line. We just ended a horrific, well, we haven't ended, we're still in a horrific hurricane season, and you see flooding. Well, it's the flood control district. It isn't the other local government. So these districts are the ones that really supply 90% of the water. They're the ones who are dealing with too much rain at once. Drought, on the other hand, not enough snow melt, changes that are just happening over time, and they're trying to be consistent and serve their customers the best they can.
Yeah, certainly in the Central Valley, the irrigation districts, I mean, are very important in terms of getting water, you know, first of all, recharging the groundwater, but also getting water to the farms and those kinds of things. Same thing happens in Southern California, et cetera. In fact, it's interesting, the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District was established back in the 1950s because there used to be floods all the time in that area, and they had to do something about it. We don't have that issue really as much anymore. They've done actually a pretty good job, which brings me kind of to my next question. And that is, you know, what kinds of things should these water, wastewater, flood control districts be doing to prepare for the impacts of climate change? I mean, what are the best practices out there?
Sure. So you mentioned Fresno as one. To build on what you said, they've actually invested in a mechanism of facilities that will simultaneously control flood water in a wet year and then use it, steer it towards facilities to recharge the underground aquifers, which is a very thoughtful way of approaching it. Some of the other districts, Santa Clara Valley Water District, for example, they have the role of protecting some of our tech companies, lots of our tech companies, below sea level. Rising sea level is happening, they know it. And they have, working with multiple government partners, are trying to shore up 18 miles of shore in the hopes of protecting these tech companies from getting inundated. So they're doing levees, they're doing restorative marsh work.
I don't know if the seawater can come into hit the groundwater and then make that unusable. I don't know. That probably could be another issue that they might be looking at.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. You were talking about the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District. That's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. I was reading in your report that they recharge over 70% of their rainfall is recharged and captured, which is kind of a big thing. They were way ahead of the curve before the drought. But I guess water is so important everywhere in the state, but particularly in the valley. Mm-hmm. They were way ahead of the curve on that. So any other examples of folks that you think are doing good stuff, like in Oakland or?
Well, Riverside County comes to mind. That's similar to Fresno, Rancho California Water District. They've converted, you know, this is investing in taking out grass medians, making it drought tolerant. They have put in a program in place where they pay farmers to swap thirsty avocados, for example, for less thirsty wine grapes. So putting in place things that are going to make them resilient to the future of potentially less water.
On the cutting edge. Well, I want to thank Carol D'Alia with California's Little Hoover Commission for joining us. If you want to stay up with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, the leaders from the Valley's Local Agency Formation Commissions, or LAFCOs. David Fai from Fresno, Sarah Lytle-Penny from Stanislaus, Bill Nicholson from Merced, and David Braun from Madera.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. This is Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So what is the situation in the San Joaquin Valley when it comes to the oversight of special districts by LAFCOs, the Local Agency Formation Commissions? We're going to get the answer from some of the directors of those organizations. We have with us David Fai with the Fresno LAFCO, Sarah Lytle-Penny with the Stanislaus LAFCO, Bill Nicholson with the Merced LAFCO, and David Braun with the Madera LAFCO. Welcome to all of you. So I'm going to start with David Fai with the Fresno LAFCO. Just quickly, how many special districts in your jurisdiction?
Fresno LAFCO oversees 92 independent special districts and 28 dependent special districts. They're distinguished because independent special districts have their own appointed or elected boards. In a dependent special district, the Board of Supervisors sits as its board.
Wow, that's a lot to oversee. So, Sarah, what about in Stanislaus County? What are you overseeing?
We have 50 independent special districts and about 22 that are dependent, ranging from irrigation districts, water districts, sewer districts, and maybe things that you don't think about, like mosquito abatement districts.
Right. So you're every week you're looking at a new special district, it sounds like. Bill, what about in Merced? How many special districts is the LAFCO kind of monitoring there?
Yeah, we have 53 special districts and really only one dependent district, which is a county service area, which is countywide in our county. Most counties have multiple county service areas, but they're governed by the Board of Supervisors. And again, we have a wide range of special districts, including one of the other type of cemetery districts,
right,
that wasn't mentioned, healthcare districts.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the number of types of special districts that are out there. I mean, it really does run the gamut, almost literally A to Z. So Dave Braun in Madera, the LAFCO there, what are you guys monitoring in terms of special districts?
Well, we have approximately 20 independent districts, and then we have 11 dependent districts that are run by the Board of Supervisors. And like a number of the other EOs said, we have cemetery districts, water districts, a variety of different kinds of special districts.
Yeah, probably have a mosquito abatement district there as well.
Yes, we do.
And that was a guess on my part, but yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah,
how many of the
resource
the
conservation districts? Yes,
right. Well, let me ask Sarah. Stanislaus. You know, in an earlier segment, we were talking about LAFCO's ability to conduct these things called municipal service reviews. I'm wondering, you know, your staffs generally, these LAFCOs, are not really that large. Do you have enough staff to do this work?
So we actually have a staff of three, including myself and a clerk and then an assistant EO. The assistant EO, majority of his work revolves around the municipal service reviews. We try to keep them on a rotating schedule to spread them out, but they do take a lot of our staff time. If we do any in-depth reviews, those typically require a consultant.
I'm willing to bet here that you wouldn't turn down more staff support.
Probably
I don't want to put you on the spot, but it seems like you think you're talking about 50 or so districts you were covering. You've got three staff. I mean, that is asking a lot of the staff. But I'm wondering what it's like in other situations. So, Bill, you know, in Merced, how many staff do you have to cover all the districts you've got to cover?
Well, I just want to say Sarah's got it good.
Yeah,
Merced and many LAFCOs are actually part-time. And so I don't have any staff. I rely on county planning department support, definitely for clerical, but the planner support is hit or miss depending on other priorities of the county. And so we're just part-time. We don't – well, I shouldn't say that. We have prepared – two municipal service reviews in-house for water districts. Otherwise, we always have to hire a consultant, and it takes the commission allocating funds to do that, and so they don't do that very frequently. So it's a big burden to meet the state mandates without having not even a full-time LAFCO, let alone a full-time LAFCO with limited staff. So
you know,
being part-time, we're really struggling.
Yeah, you weren't kidding when you said she has it better if you guys are part-time. But that also makes me think that, you know, then, frankly, there's probably little oversight of these special districts. So it's kind of a situation. It might be penny-wise and pound-foolish. You're not spending a lot of money on the LAFCO, but that means you're not monitoring all the money that's going through these special districts. That's something that people might want to take a closer look at. Dave Fai in Fresno, how big is your staff?
It's myself and three staff. I've got two analysts and an office assistant.
And you're covering how many districts again?
And we're covering 92. Well, we're covering 15 cities, 92 independent special districts, and 28 dependent special districts.
Now, I don't want to make your argument for you here, but it sounds to me like all of you guys could probably use a little more staff, to get some of these municipal service reviews done, it would seem. Let me kind of turn my attention to another issue. Bill, let me ask you, in Merced County, one of the big issues when it comes to special districts is what we do with those special districts that really have outlived their usefulness. Should they be consolidated? Should they be dissolved? I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the process. Is it an effective and efficient process the way it sets up now?
No. And there is a recent legislation that helped out last year. It was SB 88, which allows the State Water Resources Control Board to initiate consolidations. It actually allows them to do the whole consolidation and exclude LAFCO. Fortunately, the department has worked cooperatively in Merced County's case, and I've heard in many other counties they also coordinate. But it involves small districts or mutual water companies that provide water. It doesn't deal with sewer or hospitals or other services.
Yeah, that's just one.
Water.
That's just one type of special district, right? I mean, what about
one type of special district?
What about all the other ones that you think that may need to be consolidated or even closed down? Is the process working?
It's difficult. Again, the two ways to identify and analyze that, which you're required to do, is through either your municipal service review and how often you update those, it plays into that, or doing a special study, which again takes staff time to go dig into that district. And then the process can require a protest or vote by the people that live in the district to say they want to keep it, even if they're not functioning well. So it's a complicated process.
It sounds like a bit of a cumbersome, process.
Yeah.
So Dave Braun in Madera, what do you think of the process when it comes to consolidation or elimination of some of these special districts?
Well, like Bill said, I think one of the hurdles, one of the problems is the fact that the people within the district, they have the ability to protest any kind of a dissolution. So even if LAFCO initiates it and takes it through the process, ultimately the people within the district, they can just protest it and, the dissolution doesn't happen.
Yeah, they can string it out. So Dave Fai in Fresno, it sounds like, voters are always taxpayers, are always concerned about fraud, waste, and abuse. And so you've got these special districts that may or may not be relevant anymore. And so, it probably makes some sense maybe to consolidate some and eliminate others. Is the process helpful in that regard?
The process is simply a process. I think what happens is the politics gets involved, mm-hmm. the local flavor gets involved. You may have one or two people who are have the loudest voices during the process, and the rest of the folks sort of delegate their authority or let them run it. So really, if we have a process in place, and all the LAFCOs have this process, it's a statute, and we all use it. But there's also a finesse. There's due diligence on the procedural side. So that if the commission gives staff direction, make this happen, then we can either just send out the notice and let the chips fall where they may, or we can work with the district, work with the neighbors, work with people who are concerned to make sure that if the process does get completed, then it's something that the
majority of the public, majority of the ratepayers in that district are agreeable
they've
to.
They've bought into. Sarah, what are your thoughts? In Stanislaus County, is this process too cumbersome? Is it working just fine? What are your thoughts?
I think it is a little cumbersome for some of the more obvious examples of really non-controversial proposals that you still need to take through the multiple hearings and the protest hearing at the very end. We had two that we dissolved that were districts that weren't doing anything, didn't have any money on the books, should have been dissolved long ago, and no protests throughout, but we still had to hold those additional hearings.
Yeah, and then that's one of the things I think that people look at. If there's duplication of services or if the services are no longer necessary, why do these things still exist and why can't we get them off the books? Now, you know, Sarah, the legislature has made some recent changes regarding LAFCO, things like changing the how they're appointed to LAFCO, how people are appointed to LAFCO boards, you know, whether they should serve as an at-will basis or be appointed some other way. What are your thoughts on some of these changes that the legislature's done regarding LAFCO? I mean, they've also talked about giving special districts a seat at the LAFCO table or having, like we just talked about, dissolving inactive districts more quickly. Are these legislative changes regarding LAFCO and their relationship to special districts a good thing, bad thing? What are your thoughts?
I think they've been helpful so far. They're steps in the right direction to at least help for LAFCOs that do not have special district representation, including our own, to include special districts in that conversation. In terms of trying to make the decisions a little less political and having fixed seats, I think that's also a step in the right direction. Staff's always supportive of having commissioners that stay on the commission and have a little bit of background and the education regarding LAFCO. But I think there are steps going in the right direction, and including the recommendations that were in the Little Hoover Report recently.
Yeah, I want to get to that
very
in a moment.
Promising.
Yeah, I want to ask you, though, David Fye, what are your thoughts on all these legislative changes that are going on around LAFCOs and special districts? Do you like them? Are they helpful or not?
Well, the statute's been around in one form or another, and it's since 1963. And we've had statutes that merge. We've had statutes that have our operating statute has gone through significant amount of change. So I think it's a normal evolutionary process to ask the question, what if we improve this? For my LAFCO, it's been the effect is relatively neutral. It's business as usual. The law changes, we follow the law. So it just means we have to learn a new process or create a new policy to implement. In terms of the
when you have all that free time,
we have all that free time.
Right.
Like the Maytag repairman, I'm sitting there waiting for something to come in, and it's usually a tsunami come Monday, and it's I dry out by Friday.
Yeah, yeah. So David Braun and Madera, what are your thoughts on all these legislative changes? Helpful, not?
Well, in Madera County, we don't have any special district representation on our commission. As far as I understand, one of the main reasons for that is if you have special district representation, then you have to contribute toward the LAFCO budget, and a lot of these districts really don't want to, you know, get involved with that. And so in our county, we don't have special district representation.
Bill Nicholson and Merced, what are your thoughts on these legislative changes when it comes to LAFCO vis-a-vis the special districts?
Yeah, I think this latest law basically dissolving inactive districts that was SB 488 is actually one of the best things to come along in a while. It allows you to avoid the protest process and also avoid having to do a special study and big report. It's simply the state controller gives you a list of the districts who haven't filed any financial statements for 3 years, and they label them in the law as inactive, and then you're able to go straight to your commission and give a list of who they are, and then you can dissolve them without all the turmoil and community outreach and all that's required. The law was actually going to go further and have districts that would be considered idle, that maybe they had filed, they have some money in the bank, but they don't do anything with it, and it just builds up, and they were going to be considered idle, and there was going to be a process to make that also go faster for dissolving, but that didn't get included. There's still a lot of pushback politically by the special districts to keep their own protection, I guess, on it from state attack. So, yeah. But that could get modified in future years. So that's a step in the right direction, because we have three districts that really don't do anything at all. And this just helps without taking a lot of staff time to get them dissolved.
Right, because you don't have a lot of staff time. Well, you know, we've only got about a minute left. I want to ask Dave Fye. He's going to represent all of you LAFCO executive directors. On this last question about the Little Hoover Commission, you know, they did a report. They were very positive about LAFCO's, saying, you know, they operate at the local level. They're in the best position to reflect the views of local voters. And they basically wanted the legislature and the governor, frankly, to back off and let LAFCO deal with its own deliberative process. That being said, you know, the Little Hoover Commission did note that they did want the governor and the legislator to get involved when, quote, the local governing elites are so intransigent or negligent or so beholden to entrenched power structures that some form of political authority is necessary, unquote. So, of course, the devil is always in the details. I'm just going to ask you, Dave, quickly, if you could, how do you know when that's the case?
Well, ultimately, the commissioners are either elected officials from the county or from the cities, in some cases special districts. And they're ultimately accountable to the bodies that appoint them and to the voters. So it boils down to, are the voters interested in good government? And they need to communicate that to their elected officials that serve on LAFCO.
That's a great summary. I want to thank our guests very much for joining us. Up next, we're going to talk to one special district in the Valley that's considered a model statewide. We'll hear from them next.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. On KMJ.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Matty Institute. We've been talking about these little-known but highly influential special districts in California that generate over $20 billion in revenue. One such special district that was recently singled out by the Little Hoover Commission as a model was the Valley's very own Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District. Its general manager, Alan Hoffman, is with us to talk about what got them singled out in a good way. So welcome to the Matty Report.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District, your mission, how you're governed, how you're funded, et cetera.
So we were formed in 1955. A citizens group came and decided there was too much flooding in Fresno, got a citizens group together, and they studied it and got to the legislature, and the legislature created a Fresno Flood Control District Act. And they sent it out to the voters to say that if you want this agency, you got to vote on it. And we were approved by a 5-1 majority vote.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, because you know they live in town, they don't realize how bad the flooding was before you guys existed.
Yeah, we have many pictures of back in the 20s and 30s where, yeah, the whole downtown was flooded.
You need to remind people that. People now still see a little flooding on their streets because of the way things are, but nothing like you're experiencing back in the 50s and before that.
Yeah, we've built millions of dollars of infrastructure in order to, you know, accommodate that. But, yeah, we try. One of our purposes is to, you know, control all those storm waters and to try to protect property, and also so there's no inconvenience to the public.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I originally came here from the East Coast 30 years ago, but when I saw these ponding basins that you guys have all around town, like, what? There's so many lakes in Fresno. I didn't realize. Am I in Minneapolis, you know, or am I in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes? And these are actually basins that you collect water in and then recharges the groundwater, correct?
Yeah. Fresno's just too flat to think that we can drain everything to the ocean or to the river. So we, the original designers of the system, came up with this ponding basin, is what we call them. And all these ponding basins, there's, you know, over 150 of them all throughout the community. That's where we store the water, and then we move water in between them and eventually to the canal system, which takes the water out,
right.
Out of
you,
the
you
community.
Have to be one of the major landowners. You know, in Fresno. I mean, you have a lot of acreage.
We have a lot of acreage, and we recognize that we, besides school districts and maybe Caltrans and others, we are a very large landowner in this community.
And of course, that means you're going to have to be buying new land all the time to place these ponding basins in other places, correct?
Our ponding basin is probably one of the most expensive parts of our system. And so we actually took $30 million out in loans and been paying a debt service on that to buy them as early as we could to try to keep the cost down. In January, we will make the final payment on that $30 million loan and be debt-free of those loans.
Congratulations. But yeah, that does take a lot of foresight, right? Because you're always thinking about where's the next, you know, boom area going to be? Do we have ponding basins out there to recharge the groundwater? I mean, you're constantly thinking that way.
Yeah, we design well ahead of – we use the city's general plans, but we design well out ahead of development to try to be prepared and ready for them before they get there.
And where does the money come from? How do you get funded?
So we're funded by a portion of the property tax. The voters, when they put us into being, gave us part of the property tax. We've formed a special benefit assessment back in the 80s to fund the Corps of Engineers project that we did. And then we have other service charges, and we've been very successful in our capital infrastructure program in grants. There's been a lot of stormwater grants, and we've been very successful in this Central Valley to get
bring
our
that
share.
Bring that money into the community.
Bring that money
you
in.
You know, it's interesting. The Governor's Office of Emergency Services actually has a portion on their website where you can actually look up your risk of earthquake, fire, flood, et cetera. So I was doing one based on my address, you know, and zip code, and I found out that the only risk I have – it's very safe living in the valley, actually, when it comes to these emergencies, but we do have flood. Is an issue. And I'm in a floodplain, apparently. But thanks to the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District, I'm not getting flooded. So that's a good thing. But, you know, besides flooding, you know, the Flood Control District probably needs to be considering, at least thinking about, the impacts of climate change. You know, less participation here, more there. What are you guys doing to deal with the impact of climate change as it's occurring?
I think that was a part of the reason why we were asked as an agency to come talk to the Little Hoover Commission. You know, they talk about all the things climate change is doing with the ocean level, sea level rise, but they wanted to understand what are the people off of the coast doing. And so they brought us in, and really what we're looking is the change in magnitude of storms. When thunderstorms happen and we get more volumes of water quicker. Just how is it impacting the flooding of the streets? What can we do to try to mitigate that? We're looking at our basin capacity standards. Do we need to hold more water in those basins? We'd already gone from about 3 inches of storage up to 6 inches, so we doubled the capacity of our current. But should we even go farther to be able to hold more rain water? Partially because stormwater has become so important in this whole Sustainable Groundwater Management Act.
Right, right. And as people may or may not be aware, you know, when we were in the drought, there was a tremendous amount of groundwater pumping to the point where we actually had subsidence, where there's some areas where the ground was actually sinking because the aquifer was being – all the water was being taken out. So the recharging the groundwater is really significant, particularly in times of drought.
Yeah, and in the Fresno area, obviously that's all we're doing. We're recharging surface water during the summer, and then our basins are naturally a groundwater recharge during the winter. So we're putting stormwater to very beneficial uses.
Yeah, incredibly efficient that way. You know, another thing that's kind of interesting about you guys is you've built some incredible parks around the community adjacent to your park basins. One is Osa de Oro, the other is Trolley Creek Park. People in the area probably know of those locations. In fact, I was telling you off air earlier when my mom visited from San Diego, she wanted to see the sights of Fresno Clovis. I was thinking, what am I going to show her? And I actually brought her to Osa de Oro Park, and she was so impressed. And it's an award-winning park. You guys have done absolutely a phenomenal job. And it seems like that's the kind of project that really would have bipartisan support, because on the one hand, conservatives probably like it because you're more efficiently utilizing this public asset that you have. And then it's probably something that liberals would like because it creates more park space in the process. So what inspired the district to get involved in this?
Osa de Oro is actually named the Sloan Johnson Osa de Oro Park. And Sloan Johnson was a board member on our board. And it was really her brainchild to say, what can we do to create a park? Do we have extra space in a basin that we could actually turn into and have it for the physically challenged? So she got a group of professionals together to talk about what they felt needed to be in the design of a park. And so our board kind of wrapped their arms around it. Certainly the community did. And we had a lot of support and fundraisers and that to see that be built.
But and that's so, actually an award-winning park.
It is known, yeah, throughout the country. We've had both local, state, national awards on that park as we put it together and as it continues to serve the community.
You know, it's interesting. For those folks who want to find out what this park looks like, you can go on your website and find the location for Oso Dairo Park. And you can also look on their website for probably Trolley Creek Park. That's another park, Trolley Creek Park, which is in the southeast part, I believe, of Fresno, behind a Walmart, as I recall. And it's another park, absolutely spectacular. So you have this land adjacent to a recharge basin. And my I haven't been there in a while, but my recollection was you had kind of replicas of important buildings of Fresno that were part of this park for kids.
Yeah, we did it kind of as a historical landmark to Fresno. We have a simulation of the Mukes home. We have the Fresno Water Tower. We have an old 1929 Bernie trolley car that used to run through the streets of Fresno years ago. And so, yeah, we've put all that together. And our two parks are so heavily used by folks that we finally realized we needed to come up with some system to help them make.
And, you know, and that's not the only parks you have. You also have ball fields on some of your parks. I know in Clovis, for example, you have a recharge basin that doubles as a ball field when it's not full.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, if you ever, that's a true rainout. When you have a rainout at that ball field, you are not playing. It's full of water. But that's another thing you guys have done.
Yeah, the Little League department, Little League came to us and said, what can we do? And then certainly the Harry Grabian Foundation gave us a big influx of funding to be able to build the River Park Little League up in one of our basins in North Fresno.
Well, it's great to find a great example of a government agency that's run extremely well and cited by others right here in the Valley. I want to thank Alan Hoffman from the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District, as well as LAFCO representatives David Fye, Sarah Lytle Pinney, Bill Nicholson, and Dave Braun. Thanks all of you for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matter Report, visit our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.